Ramsey with your worldwide news update. Palestinian medics said dozens of people were killed and wounded in an Israeli strike on a house in northern Gaza early on Sunday. It comes as hopes for a ceasefire deal between Hamas and Israel fade further after Qatar said it was stalling its mediation efforts until both sides show they are serious about ending the war. Reuters correspondent Diane Toe reports.
In video obtained by Reuters, a relative of the deceased says the building that was hit in Jabalia was sheltering dozens of his family members. They included children, all displaced by the war. The Israeli military said it struck a site in Jabalia in which terrorists were operating, adding that the details were under review. On Saturday, Qatar's foreign ministry said the country told Israel and Hamas 10 days ago, during the last try to reach a deal, it would stall its mediation efforts if nothing came of those talks. It said, quote, Qatar will resume those efforts with its partners when the parties show their willingness and seriousness to end the brutal war. The latest round of talks in October failed to produce an agreement, with Hamas rejecting a short-term ceasefire proposal. Israel has previously rejected some proposals for longer truces. Disagreements have centered on the long-term future of Hamas and Israel's presence in Gaza. Hamas wants an agreement that ends the war and a prisoner-for-hostages deal. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says the war will only stop once Hamas is eradicated. Qatar, along with Egypt and the United States, have been working for months on fruitless talks between the warring sides in Gaza. Any disengagement from that process could further complicate efforts to reach a deal.
Reuters correspondent Diane Toe. This is VOA News. A source familiar with the conversation told Reuters on Sunday that U.S. President-elect Donald Trump spoke with Russian President Vladimir Putin and advised him not to escalate the Ukraine war, as President Joe Biden plans to urge Trump not to abandon Kyiv. The source said Trump and Putin spoke in recent days. Trump spoke with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky on Wednesday. Trump has criticized the scale of U.S. military and financial support for Kyiv, vowing to end the war quickly without saying how. The White House said Biden has invited Trump to come to the Oval Office on Wednesday. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said on Sunday that Biden's top message will be his commitment to ensure a peaceful transfer of power, and he will also talk to Trump about what's happening in Europe, Asia, and the Middle East. China has published baselines for a contested shoal in the South China Sea it had seized from the Philippines, a move that's likely to increase tensions over overlapping territorial claims. AP correspondent Karen Chamas reports.
China's foreign ministry on Sunday posted online geographic coordinates for the baselines around Scarborough Shoal. A nation's territorial waters and exclusive economic zone are typically defined as the distance from the baselines. Both China and the Philippines claim Scarborough Shoal and other outcroppings in the South China Sea. A 2016 ruling by an international arbitration court found that most Chinese claims in the South China Sea were invalid, but Beijing refuses to abide by it. I'm Karen Chamas.
From China and the Philippines have collided several times as part of increased confrontations, and the Chinese Coast Guard has blasted Philippine vessels with water cannons. A transitionary council created to reestablish democratic order in Haiti has signed a decree firing the country's interim prime minister, Gary Gonyi, replacing him with Alex Didi Felice Ami, a businessman who was previously considered for the job. The decree, set to publish on Monday, was provided to the Associated Press by a government source. It marks even more turmoil in an already rocky democratic transition process for Haiti, which hasn't held democratic elections in years, in large part due to the soaring levels of gang violence plaguing the Caribbean nation. Gonyi, a longtime civil servant who has worked with the United Nations, served as prime minister for only 6 months. The Transitional Council was established in April, tasked with choosing Haiti's next prime minister and cabinet, with the hope that it would help quell turmoil in Haiti. That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Israel-Hamas ceasefire talks are on hold.
In a statement on social media, Qatar's foreign ministry said efforts to broker such a deal would resume when Israel and Hamas showed their willingness and seriousness to end the war.
Both supporters of and detractors of President-elect Donald Trump await his next moves.
After a decisive electoral victory, all eyes are now on President-elect Donald Trump and how he will govern.
And the election and the economy.
Let's make this clear. This is not something that China pays out of pocket. There's no mechanism for that. That's not how it works.
Today is Monday, November 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Steve Karish. We begin today in the Middle East. Qatar pauses the ceasefire negotiations between Israel and Hamas, citing the two sides' unwillingness and unseriousness to stop the bloodshed. VOA's Arash Arabasadi reports.
A helicopter above, an explosion below. In the courtyard of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in the central Gaza Strip, Israel continues its war campaign against Hamas targets in the region. Local authorities say at least three died in this attack. While in the city of Khan Yunis, Palestinian medical officials said at least 13 people died in Israeli airstrikes early Saturday. An Associated Press journalist at the Nasser Hospital counted the bodies. The ongoing violence prompted Qatari officials who serve as key mediators between Israel and Hamas to announce a pause in efforts to broker a ceasefire deal. In a statement on social media, Qatar's foreign ministry said efforts to broker such a deal would resume when Israel and Hamas showed their willingness and seriousness to end the war. Meanwhile, in Tel Aviv, Israel, thousands of demonstrators returned to the streets demanding their government reach a ceasefire with Hamas to free hostages still held more than 13 months since the October 7 terror attacks on Israel that triggered the conflict. Protester Eyal Tiskim speaking with the Associated Press.
We have to have the voice of the people. I'm here today because the situation is terrible. It's been 400 days and the hostages are still in Gaza. There's a war without a direction. It's so sad. It's a big tragedy. And the government has to listen to the people. This is our way of protesting.
While simultaneously attacking targets in Gaza, Israel also launched strikes into parts of its northern neighbor, Lebanon. Israel says it's targeting members of the Iran-backed Western-identified terror group Hezbollah. With scenes similar to Gaza, parts of Lebanon are now dust and rubble, twisted metal, with rescuers digging through rocks using their bare hands. Lebanese officials say dozens died in the attacks, with some needing DNA testing to identify their remains. More protests and strikes come against the backdrop of violence in Amsterdam. Dutch officials said young people there attacked Israeli fans after a soccer match. Authorities said social media posts called for targeting Jews and they shut down all demonstrations for the weekend. Reports say some of the Israeli fans had torn a Palestinian flag off a building and chanted anti-Arab slogans on their way to the stadium. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
Dutch police took away more than 100 pro-Palestinian protesters at a rally on Sunday. This after a court extended a temporary ban on demonstrations following anti-Semitic violence on Thursday night. Reuters' Diane Toe has that story.
Scuffles broke out as riot police in Amsterdam tried to break up a pro-Palestinian rally on Sunday. It came after a court extended a ban on demonstrations following clashes with Israeli soccer fans that have been described as anti-Semitic. Hundreds of protesters were defying the ban as they gathered in the Dutch capital's Dam Square.
Free Palestine!
They chanted slogans calling for an end to violence in Gaza. As police moved in and instructed protesters to leave, several people were seen being dragged away. One demonstrator collapsed, and officers were seen tending to him. A court had ordered a three-day ban starting Friday after attacks on supporters of Maccabi Tel Aviv following Thursday's match with Amsterdam's Ajax. Dozens of Israeli supporters were chased and assaulted. At least five of them were injured.
Haatdragende antisemitische.
Amsterdam Mayor Femke Halsema described the attackers as anti-Semitic hit-and-run squads. Some visiting Israeli fans burned a Palestinian flag and used pipes and rocks in clashes with opponents, according to a video and police report. On Sunday, the court extended the ban until Thursday. According to a Dutch news station, a local police chief told the court on Sunday that anti-Semitic incidents continued to be reported the night before. The Netherlands has seen a rise in anti-Semitic incidents since the Gaza war began in October last year.
That's Diane Toe of Reuters reporting for us today. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu reacted to the violence against Israelis in the Netherlands. He said a clear line connects two anti-Semitic attacks against Israel on Dutch soil. The criminal legal attack against the State of Israel at the International Court of Justice in The Hague, and the criminal violent attack against the citizens of Israel on the streets of Amsterdam. In both cases, it's dangerous anti-Semitism that aims to make the Jews and their country helpless. Netanyahu also said that the Prime Minister of the Netherlands called him and said he was ashamed of the anti-Semitism in Amsterdam. In a related story, Netanyahu also said that he's spoken with U.S. President-elect Donald Trump three times in recent days, saying the talks were very good and important, and that they see eye to eye on the Iranian threat, but he offered no specifics. Moving now to Russia's war against Ukraine. Ukraine attacked Moscow on Sunday with at least 34 drones. It was the biggest drone strike on the Russian capital since the start of the war in 2022. The defense ministry said Russian air defenses destroyed another 50 drones over other regions of western Russia. This follows a Russian attack on the southern Ukrainian city of Odessa. That's the voice of Petro, who did not give his last name. He said he heard a drone approaching and was thrown to the ground by the blast wave when it struck a nearby house. Ukrainian officials say that residential buildings, garages, and shops were damaged. Meanwhile, in an interview aired on the BBC on Sunday, British Chief of the Defense Staff, Admiral Sir Tony Radakin, explained what he called the extraordinary price Russians were paying for President Vladimir Putin's invasion.
Russia is paying an extraordinary price for Putin's illegal invasion. So October was the worst casualty figures for Russia so far. On average, over 1,500 people either killed or wounded every single day.
Every day.
Every single day. And that is for tiny increments of land.
Russia does not disclose an official death toll. And here are some other stories we're following from around the world. On Sunday, a transitionary council created to reestablish democratic order in Haiti fired interim Prime Minister Gary Conille and replaced him with Alix Didier-Fils-Aimé, a businessman who was previously considered for the job. It marks even more turmoil for Haiti, which hasn't held democratic elections in years, in large part to the soaring levels of gang violence plaguing the country. An earthquake with a preliminary magnitude of 6.8 shook eastern Cuba on Sunday, just after weeks of hurricanes and blackouts that left many on the island reeling. There was no immediate reports of major damage or injuries in Cuba. Massachusetts Supreme Court ruled that a would-be bride must return a $70,000 engagement ring to her former fiancé in a decision that upended 65 years of legal precedent. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. In American politics, as the incoming administration of President-elect Donald Trump begins to take shape, questions about how he'll implement his campaign promises or whether he'll seek retribution against his adversaries are on the minds of many Americans. Progressives, meanwhile, are reflecting on their White House loss. VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias has more.
After a decisive electoral victory, all eyes are now on President-elect Donald Trump and how he will govern. His supporters believe that even those Americans who didn't vote for the former president will see their lives improve. Former Republican presidential candidate Vivek Ramaswamy, who backs Trump, appeared Sunday on ABC's This Week show.
I think a lot of people across the country, even who have bought into, I think, some false narratives about Donald Trump, are going to be pleasantly surprised as to finding more money in their paycheck, prices coming down in the country, a secure border.
With the selection of Susie Wiles as Trump's chief of staff, the president-elect's administration is already taking shape. The former president took to his Truth social media platform Saturday to make clear, however, that neither former U.S. ambassador to the U.N. Nikki Haley nor Trump's former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo will be invited to join his cabinet this time around. Meanwhile, questions have been raised about whether Trump will act on promises he's made to seek revenge against his political enemies and those who have pursued legal cases against him. Former Republican presidential candidate Vivek Ramaswamy commented on the matter on ABC.
I'm going to tell you what Donald Trump has said on this time and again. Success will be our retribution. Success will be our vengeance.
For those who supported the Democratic presidential campaign of Vice President Kamala Harris, this is a time of reflection. Independent Senator Bernie Sanders shared his thoughts on the matter when appearing Sunday on CNN's State of the Union.
The working class of this country is angry, and they have a reason to be angry. We are living in an economy today, Donna, where the people on top are doing phenomenally well, while 60% of our people are living paycheck to paycheck.
While praising the Biden administration's achievements, Senator Sanders said there's more work to be done.
We need an agenda that says to the working class, we're going to take on these powerful special interests and create an economy and a government that works for you. And by the way, that can't happen unless you get big money out of politics.
U.S. President Joe Biden has promised there will be a peaceful transfer of power on January 20th. Biden called Trump to congratulate him after his election win, and the two are scheduled to meet in person Wednesday at the White House. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
I think it's fair to say that the economy is always an important issue in people's lives and in many of the decisions they make, and voting is no exception. As we heard Senator Bernie Sanders say in the last story, following last week's election, many believe that Vice President Kamala Harris and her team did not say or do enough to address voters' economic concerns, particularly for the working class. For a look at the election and the economy, I'm joined by Mark Hamrick, Senior Economic Analyst and Washington Bureau Chief at Bankrate.com.
I would never want to take issue with an individual or household's own assessment of their own personal finances. I think they're in the best position to state where they think those are. In our bank rate survey, we identified three major economic issues as told to us by Americans. The number one issue was inflation. The number two issue was healthcare costs. And the number three issue was affordable housing. Those are all issues that have to do with being able to pay for things. Our bank rate survey did indicate that Republicans said the economy was on the wrong track, and by and large, Democrats had a tendency to say it was on the right track. And I think the view really changes because of sort of the timeline that one might be judging that. It may well be that Democrats were viewing it in a narrow lens of things are getting better compared to a couple of years ago, and Republicans might have been taking a longer view. But I do think that there are structural long-term issues that are of interest to all Americans, no matter what political jersey they might be wearing, which team they might be cheering for. And if we look at those issues number two and three, healthcare costs and affordable housing, those are in a sense structural issues that have been sort of crying for an effective solution on the part of elected officials. And of course, the question number one, can they do anything about it? Number two is, Would they do anything about it? And obviously now with new lawmakers and a president coming into the White House, they have an opportunity. We'll see what they can work out.
Do you think the Democrats simply weren't communicating their successes well, or they really missed the boat that for a lot of Americans, things just weren't as good as the Democrats in the Washington, D.C. area said they were?
I think they could be all the above. I don't think those are mutually exclusive. I don't think that Vice President Harris, and obviously the result bears this out, did a good job of addressing the inflation question. In the first debate, she was asked about that, and she essentially went to talking points that didn't address the question. The other part was, I think the administration and the vice president didn't do a good job of addressing the issues of how pocketbook issues generally would be dealt with and how effectively they'd be dealt with by the administration. You can't just say that inflation isn't as bad as it was before and expect people to go on with their daily lives. I think you could do a better job of explaining how we got here, which includes the global impacts of the pandemic that were globally shared, the fact that Russia's invasion of Ukraine caused a rise in commodities prices that was felt in the United States, particularly for food and energy, more so in Europe. The other part of this is I do think that Americans sort of took hook, line, and sinker some of the campaign rhetoric on the part of both officials, both of the candidates, who said, essentially, I will fix inflation, which is essentially a promise that is not based on a reality. The president doesn't have a lever in the Oval Office to turn inflation off.
I want to change gears slightly. During the campaign, President Trump was talking about tariffs as a way to punish China, to get even with China and other countries. Vice President Harris was saying that tariffs on imports would essentially be a sales tax, make goods more expensive. Can you help us sort that out? What's the truth in that?
First of all, tariffs are effectively a tax that have to be paid by some combination of companies and consumers. And so if you're applying, let's say, a 20% across the board tariff on imported goods, that has to be passed along. And it's passed along in some combination through either the company's absorbing part of it. But that is a very high hurdle to cross when you're talking about a 20% price increase. They've already, generally speaking, tried to price competitively in the current environment. They can take a hit to their corporate profits, or they can pass the price increases along. And I think that will be the lion's share of that if this is implemented, as that stated, perhaps a 60% increase on the cost of imported goods from China. And so let's make this clear. This is not something that China pays out of pocket. There's no mechanism for that. That's not how it works. It is either paid by companies or it is paid by consumers or some combination thereof. And so that is why, in totality, many of the proposals that President Trump has talked about are seen as potentially harmful for inflation. Obviously, if you're going to raise prices of things by 20 to 60%, that's much worse than the 9% peak of inflation that we saw in June of 2022. And so we're seeing already some behaviors either seen or anticipated with respect to sort of planning for that.
So my final question for you, Mark, the election was last week. How have the markets globally reacted to Trump's reelection?
Yeah. Well, you've seen some gravitation toward companies and sectors that are seen as benefiting from his administration. One example is cryptocurrency. You've seen things like companies that are involved in the private prison business that might benefit from mass detentions benefiting. And initially, you saw some benefit for banks. If, for example, there is broadly what I think is a safe bet at this point, an ability to have a higher level of mergers and acquisitions, and that would apply broadly across the spectrum. Of course, mergers and acquisitions favor bigness and do not favor smaller entities. And there are many conundrums as it applies to the president's proposals, where, you know, we know that smaller communities across the country, as well as rural areas, have not fared as well economically. One of the great engines for the U.S. economy over time is small business. So does small business sort of suffer as a casualty if mergers and acquisitions are allowed to go unfettered, much the same as regulation is cut? There are unintended consequences of some of these measures.
Mark Hamrick is a senior economic analyst and the Washington bureau chief for Bankrate.com. Mark, thanks for your time. Thanks for your analysis today.
My pleasure, Steve. Thanks for having me.
In parts of Ukraine occupied by Russia, Ukrainian officials can suddenly find themselves at the mercy of Moscow and cut off from Kyiv. And that's just what happened to one judge in Balakia, about 70 kilometers from Kharkiv. Anna Kostachenko has his story.
45-year-old Balaklia District Court Judge Volodymyr Strigunenko recalls what happened after Russian forces began their six-month occupation of the Kharkiv region in March of 2022. Strigunenko and his colleagues hid valuables in the courtroom vault, but Russian soldiers broke the locks and looted the room, he says.
They found a way to open everything without keys, simply cutting off the locks. There were probably around five safe boxes here, and they took at least eight large TVs, the ones used to broadcasting court sessions and video recordings.
Strigunenko also says that he saw Russian forces torturing local residents.
They tortured several people to death here. One was Maxim Shelikhan. He worked as a lawyer. Then the son of our colleague, Artur Serenko, went missing, and until this day, there's no information about his whereabouts.
Strigunenko was among those the Russians captured. On June 3, 2022, an unfamiliar car arrived in his yard. Two masked soldiers then took him to the occupied police station, where a torture chamber had been set up. There they invited the judge to hand down sentences for them.
There were fresh blood stains under my feet. They offered me a job. I told them that I would not do this, that I was a Ukrainian judge.
The day Strigunenko was allowed to leave. However, a few days later, on June 7, 2022, Russian soldiers visited his home again.
They opened the door and immediately started punching me in the face.
Then they took Strigunenko with them. The man's neighbor, Valentina, who did not want her last name mentioned for security reasons, saw the invaders kidnap the judge and rob his apartment in the process.
All of us neighbors were fearing. We saw who came in, what they took. They started taking out suitcases, packing stuff, everything. It was really scary. And then they took him.
Russian soldiers took Strigunenko to his unfinished country house, where they demanded he legally transfer his property to them, he recalls. When he refused, they took him to the torture chamber again. There he was beaten, his jaw was broken. Strigunenko says it was his mother who saved him. His neighbors called her and told her about her son having been kidnapped, and she pleaded for the Russians to let her son live alive.
Someone later told me I have a powerful guardian angel. Well, a powerful guardian angel and supportive parents.
On September 8, 2022, Balaklia was liberated by Ukraine's armed forces. On June 1, 2023, the court in Balaklia resumed its normal work. And Strigunenko is working his way through more than 1,000 cases, some of which involve crimes committed by local defectors. Anna Kostichenko for VOA News, Kharkiv Region, Ukraine.
And that'll wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform. and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Steve Karish.